Hello and welcome to Wooden Spoons on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. My name is John Dick, and I'm here with community nutritionist Mary Jane Eason to discuss topics of healthy living, environmental issues, what's going on in our community, as well as other interesting things in this one-hour show. On Wooden Spoons, we recognize that all things are related, and with learning and awareness, we connect the dots that make up our world. Every Friday morning on Wooden Spoons, we speak with guests on today's relevant issues, share nutritious recipes, and explore important topics with perspectives not found in the mainstream media. Time right now is 8 o'clock a.m., and temperature outside is 21 degrees Celsius. Good morning, Mary Jane.
Good morning.
Morning. Sorry about that.
Okay, so we're going to be beginning our program with Wooden Spoons, and I just want to make the acknowledgement that on Wooden Spoons, we acknowledge that we are located on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional land and waters of the Cree, Ojibwe, Dakota, and Dene people, as well as the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis homeland. We also acknowledge the Shoal Lake No. 40 First Nation and its territory for our life-giving water. So this morning, I'm just going to run down what we're going to be doing this morning in our show. The first half of the program, for at least the first half, we have a guest who I'll be introducing shortly. And during the second half, there will be some commentary on the rights of nature and also issues with vegetable oils, brominating vegetable oils, and some updates on the National Citizens Inquiry, and so on. And we will end with a recipe. So on that note, I'd like to introduce our guests this morning. They are Fran and Dan Durook, and from the Durook Stop of the Hill Farm, close to Treherne, Manitoba, which is located about 150 kilometers southwest of Winnipeg. Dan's parents, Jerry and Marie, were farmers raising cattle and growing grain. And theirs was a life of hard work of clearing the land to raise cattle and crops. And Dan learned about caring for the land and animals from his father. When he grew up, he moved to Brandon, Manitoba to pursue a career in auto mechanics. And then in 1984, Dan met Fran and they got married. They have 5 grown children. They will correct me if I'm wrong. And today we'll be talking to Dan and Fran about how their business emerged and evolved into a food processing plant that is certified organic by OPAM. We will learn about the variety of flowers and seeds that they sell and why their products are so important to our health today. So welcome to Wooden Spoons, Dan and Fran.
Well, good morning, and thanks for having us. Good morning.
Good morning. You sound very bright this morning, so you must be early risers, right?
Yeah, so-so, I guess, yeah.
We do it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, maybe we could begin with, I remember your parents, I think, Dan, your parents, that used to deliver the product, like what you're now doing. What's the name? Jerry and Marie?
Marie. Jerry and Marie, yeah.
I remember them very clearly. That was quite a while ago. So, Dan.
Yeah, no, they've been for a while now, so that's right.
Yeah, but I remember them. They were our first contact with those products. And so anyway, maybe Dan, you could tell us how you began with caring for animals and growing crops, but how you eventually gave up animal husbandry and focused on grain farming, and then also cleaning and milling your own grain. So how did that transition take place for you?
Well, like you said at the beginning there, so I grew up on a farm, and so we grew up as a mixed operation. So we always ran hogs, cattle, and grain growing up. So I was used to having a diverse farm. We did that just to generate income all year round. So then after I graduated from school, I went to Brandon, and I came back in 1998. Brandon and I decided to come back and farm. And so we started our operation in the same way. We started off with animals. We did the hogs and the cattle there too, just to kind of have a diverse income there. And the grain we grew at that time was mostly just to feed our livestock. That was kind of our main source of income, was animals. We also had raised chickens back then too, and that's when we started getting our direct marketing career going. We're direct selling off the farm that way. But then as time went on, with the hog industry, it changed quite a bit. So the corporation at that point changed to a different model. They were starting to supply their own plants with their own animals. So we were kind of too small, so they phased us out, basically. So that kind of ended the hog operation here on our farm. And then, but we ran cattle for right since the day one. And so in about the early 2000s, BSE had hit us. And so that kind of changed our cattle operation by quite a bit. So we had to figure out how we were going to make a living off of cattle. So we got rid of the main herd, and then we switched to different genetics. And then we decided to go into grass-fed beef. So again, direct marketing that again there too. So so we've been doing grass-fed now, I think, for about 10 years or so. But the cattle, we're going to be starting to phase out of that here now, maybe this year or next year.
We're getting old.
Yeah. we're finding that we're getting older now, and it's a little bit much tri-handle cattle. So I think we're going to phase out of that there this year.
Well, it sounds like such an immense amount of work raising cattle and animals for the farm, and you both look very youthful. I'm always amazed how healthy you do look. So, but it must be just a tremendous amount of work what you had been doing, and the transition might have been, I guess that. But you talked about direct marketing. So why did you do that? Like, what it means, you're going directly to the customer, right?
Right. And the things we found, I mean, in the conventional food system, you grow a product that you do your best, but then by the time you get it to market, you couldn't control your pricing, so you were just at the mercy of whatever they were going to pay you that year. So you were kind of stuck, and then with all the deductions and everything else, so by the time the farmer was said and done, there wasn't much left for the farmer there anymore. So we thought, well, we'd try to capture some of the dollars that were possibly available. So that's kind of why we went with the direct marketing thing. It is a little bit more work, no doubt, but it's actually worked out well for us.
So. Yeah, and you do, and when you say direct marketing, what does that mean? Like, do you you go to your customers, and they also come to you, right?
Yeah, well, I guess, well, with the chickens and the beef, I guess, the customers approach us. So
word of mouth?
Yeah, word of mouth gets around pretty quick. I mean, yeah, people like good food, so word of mouth gets around pretty quick, and it's just a matter of supplying them with that product. And it works for the same thing with our grains there, too. I mean, we kind of, it's kind of word of mouth is how we kind of advertise that way. So it's worked out well that way.
Mm-hmm. And you do come to the city on a regular basis and deliver to different places. Do you want to share where you bring your products to? I think Tallgrass sells your products, your flowers and things like that.
Yeah, we have quite a few major customers. That's more friends.
Yes. Yeah, Tallgrass, we use our products, and some of the other breweries as well, like Hildegard's and Ida, and there's a few other bakeries in outside of Winnipeg as well, in Niverville and Steinbach and Morton and Winkler and Brandon and all kinds of places.
So that's quite remarkable. You have to be on the road quite a lot because, like, you have to deliver as well. So that takes a lot of time.
Yeah, we're on the road about 4 days a month, I guess.
Uh-huh.
So we do a delivery in Winnipeg, and we do a southeastern run with Gordon, Winkler, Plum Coulee, sign back, and then back through Winnipeg again for those that need some extra products. And then we do a Western trip as well. So the Clearwater, Cartwright, Killarney, Boisevain, and into Brandon and anybody else along the way.
That's just quite remarkable. And then, you know, as a comment about the life of a farmer in your case, there's a lot of work, but it changes with the season. So it's not always the same. Do you want to just comment on you know, the work that you do from season to season at your Top of the Hill farm?
Well, sure. we're busy all year round.
Yes.
We're not farmers where they have a little bit of a break over the winter or over the summer or however they do their products and things. But yeah, we're kind of busy. Like I say, we're delivering 5 days each month. And then we also have the farming side of things where we're you seed in the springtime and then it grows over the summer. And during the summer, we're putting hay up for the cattle. And then
you still have cattle, right? You still have cattle.
We still have cattle. So we have to have food for them in the wintertime, so we have to put the hay. And then comes harvest. And then so it takes a few weeks in the fall to get everything brought in. And squeezed in between all that, we still have to make the product. So we're cleaning the seeds and de-hulling and making flour and flakes and all kinds of fun stuff to do.
Yeah, you never have a down season, I don't think. It's always like, it sounds like it's full force for you know, all the time. It's that's the life of farming. You just can't take a break, you know, because things...
Well, it all depends what kind of farming you do.
Yeah.
But we seem to not like to sit still very much, I guess. Yeah, so we're pretty much busy. We have to make time to get away from it all a little bit, but we try and do that a little bit.
Yes. I understand, Dan, that your father, like all the farmers in your area, they use chemicals in farming, but your parents, I think your parents, they just switched to organic farming, and then you also became an organic farmer. With organic certification by OPAM. Maybe you might want to explain that acronym, OPAM. And do you want to describe the process that took place and why the move to becoming organic in a community where all your farmer neighbors reuse chemicals, how did that work out and how did you come to that decision? You know, how was it to switch over from using chemicals to becoming totally organic?
Yeah, no, well, first of all, OPAM stands for Organic Producers Association of Manitoba. So that is our certifying body in order to get our organic certificate. So we get an inspection every year through them. So they come through and visit our farm, and they go through our records to make sure everything's all up to speed. It is a local company or local cooperative, I guess, and so that's how we get our organic certification through them. But how we got to that point, like Dad, when I came back to the farm back in '98, Dad and I, we worked together. We each had our own farm, so we managed it differently. And as time went on, we found that the products that we were using weren't as effective anymore, so we had to have more products in order to problem solve some of our production problems, and so we just didn't like kind of the direction that was going. And at that point, it was also you had to get bigger, kind of get out type of thing. So it was a different attitude towards farming, and again, so we thought, well, there had to be a better way. So Dad was having a conversation with someone, I can't remember who it was. And they mentioned to him, what about organic farming? So, and he came back with that, and he talked about it for a bit, and we thought about it for a bit. And so Dad says, well, you know what? I'm going to try about 40 acres just to see how this works out. So at that time, there wasn't much for information available locally. So Dad had attended a couple of acres conference down in the U.S. just to get some ideas of how we start this organic endeavor. So We started off with the 40 acres, but at that time, organic was fairly young, so there wasn't much from markets at that point. So he grew the 40 acres, but then at one of the conferences locally, he bumped into Tabita from Tall Grass.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that kind of started the market point. So like Tabita said, well, whatever you grow, we'll buy from you. So that's how that basically started. And then after that, more people found out that we were growing organic, but they wanted flour. So then Dad got a flour mill and an oat roller and then just built from there. So it just happened, things just fell into place and kind of expanded from there. And so by the time we hit 2006, we put our land into transition in 2004. And by 2006, we basically covered all the acres that we could grow, we could market locally as a value-added product. So it just, it just happened to work out.
Yeah, and it's wonderful because there's a real need and a real desire to be able to access organic products. You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM, and this is Wooden Spoons, and we're talking to Dan and Fran DeRook about their farm, their DeRook's Top of the Hill Farm. And I'm with John Dick, and my name is Mary Jane Eason. So this seems like it was sort of like an organic way of switching over too. You started trying a different way. And did you notice anything different? And do you feel different about the farming and how it affects you yourselves?
Well, it's different. It's a little different way of managing a farm. And again, we learn as we go type of thing. But like your mainstream farming, you have like a recipe farm. If you do these steps, you should make some money. But in organic, we use different tools to kind of get the farming going. So, I lost my train of thought. Sorry about that.
And the other thing is your products are in demand. And a lot of people are very grateful that they can acquire your organic flours and your grains and seeds and so on. So do you want to just point out some of the essential differences between in organic farming and mainstream farming and how that changed your lifestyle as well?
Well, yeah, that changed our lifestyle by quite a bit. But, it was just different tools and a different thought process, I guess, between conventional and organic.
The conventional uses the chemicals and the synthetic fertilizers and things like that. So being organic, you're not allowed to do any of that. So what we use is the green manures and the composted cattle manure and chicken manure and things like that that enriches the soil again.
Yeah, I guess the green manure is like turning over whatever plants you have. Alfalfa is probably a very good crop too, because I don't know if you use that, but it does enrich the soil with nitrogen.
Well, because we have cattle, alfalfa is part of a rotation, so that works good for both weed control and adding nutrients back into the soil. And that's one of our major green manure crops that we use. And we also use like the red clover, like Fran was saying there too. So, it's a different process and a different thinking. It's different way of doing things anyway, but like I say, we don't have all the answers yet, and we're still trying to find right combinations to make things work properly anyway.
And each year is different. You're always relying on the weather, and the last few years was very dry, so about the last 3 years, so you don't get a lot of produce when it's that dry. This year is much different. It's been nice and nice yet, really. It's nice to see a few puddles here and there that last till the next rain, and and it's replenishing the soil with the moisture that's been dried out for so long.
How did you come to acquire the land top of the hill farm, and what are the distinguishing features about this? Because that's quite an interesting idea. Top of the hill makes you wonder, you're on top of the hill, really? Or is it sort of a hill?
Yeah, that's where we are. It's not just all flat land like outside of Winnipeg. We are in the Tiger Hills. It's up on the escarpment. So we're in the very rolling, very quite beautiful, really. It's very nice and quiet, and we've got lots of trees around our place, that's for sure. So when we got the name of our farm, is we were describing how to get to our place, and you go this road and that road, and then we're at the top of the hill. So that's kind of how it came along.
Uh-huh. And then Marie and her husband, do they farm nearby as well?
Well, Marie passed away last year, so she's...
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm sorry to hear that.
No, that's fine. So in a better place there now, and looking down on us, keeping us in line. But, Jerry is still helping us on the farm. We've kind of taken over the management of the farm, and Jerry does a lot of the field work. He's still able to do that, and that's what he loves, and that's what he does really well at. So we keep him busy and keeps him happy, too.
Okay.
So
they
just come out.
And the other thing that you had to do is on your farm, when you became organic, you transformed barns and garages into facilities where you process grains and hull seeds. Do you want to tell us how that evolved, and what are some of the considerations that go into cleaning seeds and milling flour? That's a huge operation.
Okay, yeah, so we were... some of the outbuildings that we had here. So what we did is we basically stripped the building down to the rafters, and then we finished the inside, and then new cement, new walls and everything to get that all done up. And then we had to get provincial inspections done to be a food grade facility. So both buildings are done for that. So that's a yearly inspection there too on the food side. Our first design that we had on our building was a very simple basic design, but then as people wanted different products, we had to add more into the line and try and figure out processes from there. So it's still kind of an ongoing thing. At this point, I think we have everything that we need now to do most of our products. We haven't had any surprise on anything else new. It worked out pretty good. I mean, we're trying to start up and save as much money as we could, so that's why we used some of the buildings that we had. The only disadvantage was Dad lost his garage out of that, so he has to park his car outside. But other than that, it seems to fit our needs for the size we are there now. So.
And you have, like, what are some of the seeds that you offer? Do you grow your own sunflower seeds, and do you grow pumpkin seeds and things like that?
Well, we're growing sunflower seeds there now, so we got two different kinds. So one is an oil type, which we're starting to press here now for cold pressed sunflower oil. And then we also grow what they call confectionaries, and then those ones you dehull, and then the meat are used in baking products. So we do that now too. So that's been a new project within the past couple of years on that there too. So the sunflower oil is just this year. The dehulled sunflowers just the past couple of years. So, and that's what we do with that sunflowers there.
We don't do pumpkin seeds, so.
No.
I know you've been asking for them a lot.
I know pumpkin seeds are, I mean, you can buy them. They're wonderful to get, but I can imagine what that might entail. Oh, my goodness, trying to get all the pumpkin seeds out of all these pumpkins. But,
yeah.
Yeah. And then you also have a bagging machine that allows you to bag the produce for your customers. And there just seems to be so much work that you have to get done. How do you manage to do all that? You also have, and Fran, I think that you have a garden, and you probably do have a garden, and so that keeps you busy as well.
Well, the bagging part, I do the bigger bags, so they call it mini totes, so that holds a ton of product, and then we have the 50-pound bags, and then we have a machine that does that. So it's kind of by hand, but, I mean, the machine kind of weighs out the bag, and I'll sew it up and tag it. So that's my area. The smaller bags, that's basically Fran on that one.
Yeah, and I have no machine. It's all done by hand. Just put the bag and put it in the bag and sew it up, and so it's a little bit labor intensive, but it gives me an idea of what the product is doing. It's staying good and it's the right consistency and things like that. So it's good to have hands on as well.
And the bags that you have are good quality bags, and I believe that they're lined with wax. They're waxed, you know, so there's no moisture that gets in.
Right. There is a plastic lining in the bigger bag just to keep the moisture out, mm-hmm. and anything else, any little critters or whatever, it keeps it good and fresh that way. And the smaller bags also have a lining. It's a compostable lining in it so that it does compost. You just have to take the tin tie part off, and then it's good to compost that. So it's working out well.
Oh, that's really good to know. And so you're very, ecologically sound in every way. I was just wondering about, you know, the food inspectors and things like that with the organic inspections. Is Janine Gibson still the inspector, or, like, I know she was involved with that.
Yeah, well, the way that it's set up, you only have the same inspector every couple of years. So we do get different inspectors every 2 or 3 years, mm-hmm. but Janine's still involved. So we still stay in touch with her once in a while there, too. So.
And she does a lot of the training of the inspectors as well.
Yeah, I know she's been very involved, and now she's with the Green Party of Manitoba.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so she's a very busy person.
Oh, yes, very much.
Yeah, so how do you, there's, I mean, organic farming is always an iffy situation, no matter if you're doing commercial farming, which depends on chemicals and so on. But your land is going to be in better shape because you're taking care of it and putting the green mulch back into the land when you're plowing it under and so on. But what are some of the challenges? I mean, there's always going to be the problem with weeds and things like that. And how do you... manage weed control when you don't use chemicals?
Well, and the thing with farming is it's a continuous learning. I mean, we're always different things. I mean, we try different strategies, and with technology, we are able to improve our knowledge a little bit that way too. So every year we try something different. Like in the past, we kind of looked at weeds as, you know, that weeds is one particular problem. But now we're finding that we have to look at farming more like a system. So for every action we do, there's a reaction. So for many years, we were doing tillage. So that was kind of the action. But then the reaction was it's hard on the soil biology. So now what we're trying to do is we're going from monocrop, trying to get away from monocrop and do multiple species. And so that way we can kind of select the species we want in the fields, like legume crops or whatever. So we'll select for that, but then that would hopefully help control some of the weeds that we don't want, and we can reduce tillage. So we've been experimenting with that for a few years. Some successes, some didn't work out so well. But so that's one avenue that we're doing. So like I say, we're always trying to do something different. But now we look at our farm more as a system than more of just a one production idea. So Like I say, we won't have all the answers before I'm done farming. There's lots to learn yet.
Yeah, it's been a profession for many, many years.
Yes.
But with the seed that we have, when we do the multiple crops, we're able to separate all those crops and have pure products after that. So it works well that way, too.
I know that often, like the old-fashioned way was summer fallow, as they say. They used to work up the land and till all the weeds or whatever into the soil and then leave it and let it lie dormant. Is that a good way? Is that something that you do?
Well, no, we used to, but I mean the idea is to try to keep something growing on the land all the time and keep it covered. Doesn't blow. So, like I say, we're learning more as time goes on, better for the land. So that's why we're trying more plants, different species, so we're trying different ideas that way.
And a lot of the tillage will disturb the microbiology in the soil, like all the bacteria and the fungi and all those sort of things that are good for the soil.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be killing that all the time either. You still have to do
something. I guess that's what makes the soil a living thing. I mean, we have to think of soil as a living organism, really, don't we?
Yeah.
And
it's all alive in there.
Yeah.
If you take a little scoop and you get down to some nice, moist soil, then you'll find all kinds of different things living and moving around in there.
Yeah, it is really a study in itself, you know, to understand the soil. And I think when you compare the soil that is in an organic farm with those from commercial farms, you'll see quite a difference because they depend on constant application of fertilizers, which don't really work the same. Like, do you want to comment on fertilizers and how... what might be the downsides of chemical fertilizers that people use?
Other than the price?
Well, we're starting to learn more about what some of the fertilizers are doing. So we're finding that the high nitrogen use in a lot of these systems is really hard on your organic matter. So we got to try and reduce our nitrogen use and any leaching or whatever. So that's a big issue there. Some of the sprays that they're using is hard on the biology there too. So we got to try and stay away from the sprays on the conventional side. But again, as we learn more of how the soils are working, I think there'll be a shift and a change in agriculture to do a better way of farming. I don't think any farmer really wants to spray or put fertilizer on if they don't have to, if we can find a better way. So it's constantly learning different things. So
how, you know, you're in a community of people that do conventional farming, and what is the relationship like between you? I mean, they know you're different. Is there any curiosity or discussion back and forth about the pros and cons?
Like I said, we are surrounded by conventional guys, and I mean they are watching us on a regular basis to see what we're doing, how we're making out, and in some cases still not their thing yet. But I mean the curiosity is always there. I don't think any farmer is really that straight-minded that they're just going to do what they do and that's all there is to it. I think they always look at different ways of doing things better.
Mm-hmm.
They may not be at a point of doing organic yet, but I mean, maybe with the green manures or something like that, that nitrogen cost, that might be something they may look at in the future type of thing. So
mm-hmm.
We don't have a,
go ahead.
We don't have confrontations at all.
No, we don't.
No, I can see farmers like be wanting to see how things are going and back and forth, and that's great. Yeah, and I think those that are caught with in conventional farming, they're going to be seeing the erosion of their own soil. So that's why they have to put fertilizers on them, and then we get these other crops like where glyphosate is built into the crops, like the Monsanto Bayer company and their crops are really damaging. And, you know, the glyphosate has destroyed the monarch butterfly pretty much, because all the milkweed just becomes toxic because the pesticide is in the plant. The glyphosate is in the plant. So there's nothing to be recommended there.
No, and I think that's what I'd say about the technology, is that learning more, like at the time when it came out, for what the technology was there, for the most part, they thought it was a safe product. But now we're finding out, maybe as time goes on, that maybe it's not as good as we thought it was. So, yeah, I mean, I think once we find out more, I'm hoping there'll be a shift in attitude that way, too. But, yeah, there is issues with that right at this point. And we're just starting to learn about it now.
Yeah, more... I think, yeah, that's very good to know. And it's also a matter of scale, isn't it, as you were pointing out? Because
yes.
The people are being encouraged to have big farms, then they have to use all this. They have to put a lot of seed in, and they have to, you know, spray and everything. But
well, that's the way the markets are set up. It's all about volume and producing the cheapest food you can.
Yeah.
So, and that's the tools that they're using in order to get that, to supply the market with that.
Our idea is...
It's a corporate-run business, isn't it? I mean, it's all based on big corporate goals.
A lot of the bigger farms are, yeah.
Yeah.
But our idea is to have healthier, more nutritious products that you get more health benefits from it, which that's kind of our mandate, I guess. And that seems to be what's working for us. So,
you have a lot of humility in what you're doing, but you're doing a lot of great work. And just one more thing, I'd like to, you do offer, amongst the grains you grow, you have an ancient grain called einkorn. And that's very, I actually purchased some, and then I forgot about it. I found it in my pantry. Oh, my gosh, I was going to try it out. Do you want to talk about that grain? Because I want to start using it. It's very fascinating to me.
Yeah, so einkorn, I guess the way it's translated is the first wheat. So it's one of the first wheats way back in the ancient days, I guess. And so it hasn't been mucked around with, I guess. It hasn't been hybridized or anything like that. So it's just the pure grain, and that's the way it has stayed. For the baking qualities, it's got 30% less gluten, but it's got 30% more protein than the regular wheat does. So that kind of gives you a little bit of idea on the nutrition side of things.
And 30% less of what? 30%
less gluten.
Oh, gluten, yeah, because that is that's a big issue these days.
Yeah, so a lot of people are gluten sensitive, or they're just trying to stay away from it just for their own benefits, I guess. Spelt also has less gluten, and I think emmer has less gluten as well. We don't do a whole lot with the emmer, but the einkorn, we're growing it ourselves this time. And it seems to be doing well. For baking, you can kind of substitute it for a whole wheat, but it'll, which way did it go? The moisture. You'll use less moisture, I believe, is what it is. So, or more flour, I guess. I'm not sure. So you'd have to... go to Dr. Google
and just double check the recipe.
Yeah, the baking, it's all a trial and error. I mean, it all depends on the humidity outside and your temperature in the house. And
that's true, too. We have to remember that when we're baking. Yeah, it's not the, it changes with the weather for sure. The other thing I wondered, if I left it on the shelf. It's been there for a month. Is that going to have refrigerated it?
No, the flour is a little more stable than, say, like our oats or ground flax. Mm-hmm. It's best if you keep it in the freezer if you're not going to use it for a while. Mm-hmm. Freezer, the fridge, or whatever, but it'll stay good for probably a year or even more.
And you mentioned flax. You also have flax seeds for sale. So you have so people can look you up and find out all the products that you have, and they can, find out how they can get it from you or where they can buy it. So,
yeah, we do have a website that they can go to, and I guess if you just Google Durex, it will likely show up there eventually.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning, because I think you've changed so many people's lives because you've offered a good product. I know I would never, ever use the other type of flour. I just can't use it. I love to buy your flour and use it in our school, and I wouldn't think of using any other flour at this point in time. So thank you so much for making these products available to us, to the public, and you're doing a great service, and we wish you all the best.
Well, thank you very much, and we sure appreciate everything you've done to promote us as well.
Just before you go here, I actually had one question for you. Do you know anything about permaculture farming, and if so, how do you implement it on your land?
We don't do much in the permaculture part of things. I mean, we do, yeah, not as far as as feed and stuff like that, but we do have, like, our permanent pastures, so that's about the only permaculture that we would do. Any of our marginal land that's not really farmable, we'll keep it with perennials, but that's about it for that.
Yeah. We kind of already have the permaculture set up. We've got bush and trees and the birds and all that sort of stuff already, so we haven't had to add to that so much. We do have a, the university was putting
The pollinator strip.
The pollinator strips, yeah. We did a trial with that, and it's still there, actually, too, so it's benefiting the wildlife that way. And we have deer and wild turkeys and coyotes and bunny rabbits and
that's all. Cool. Okay, thank you so much for joining us, Dan and Fran. It was wonderful talking to you. And perhaps, John, maybe you could give us our station ID and we could play a song until we'll move to the next part of Wooden Spoons.
Right, you're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. Song right now is called Supper Time by Johnny Cash.
Many years ago, in days of childhood, I used to play till evening time would come, still winding down that old familiar pathway. I hear my mother call at setting sun, come home, it's supper time. The shadows lengthen fast. Come home, it's supper time. We're going home at last. Some of the fondest memories of my childhood are woven around supper time, when mother used to call from the back steps of the old home place, come on home now, son, it's supper time. My, how I'd love to hear that once again. But you know, time has woven for me a realization of a truth that's even more thrilling. That someday we'll be called together around the great supper table up there for the greatest supper time of them all with our Lord. I can almost hear the call now coming from the portals of heaven. Come home, son. It's supper time. Come on home. Come home. Come home, it's supper time. The shadows lengthen so fast. Come home, it's supper time. We're going home at last.
Hello, Mary Jane.
Okay, we're back on air from the song. I would like to continue this part of the program in Wooden Spoons. I wanted to share some information from the Organic Consumer Association. That's an American organization. And it's titled, What If Trees Were People Too? And I thought it made a lot of sense. And there is a movement, apparently, that's grounded in familiar principles of justice that you can't rob someone's house and just get away with it. So why should you be able to rob a forest of its resources? If crimes like murder, arson, and trespassing come with criminal sentences, the writer asks, this is Sarah Drum that wrote this, if what's the difference when those same crimes are committed by companies against animals and trees or rivers? Chile is in the process of drafting a new constitution that emphasizes the rights of nature, saying human survival depends on it. And if that isn't that a true statement? I mean, do we think we can not depend on nature? Nearby Panama is a step ahead, having signed legislation at the start of this year that gives nature, listen to this, it gives nature the right to exist, persist, and regenerate its life cycle. Now, we don't give nature the right, but nature has the right, and we need to understand that nature has to exist, and if we want to exist and regenerate its life cycles. In February, a top court in India ruled that Mother Nature had the same rights as a person under law. Now, that is kind of a novel idea, but it's not a crazy idea. It is something we have to recognize. I certainly agree with it. Around the world, at least 17 countries have introduced some form of nature rights law, from the U.S. to New Zealand. So this is something to be concerned about, and I know I don't have all the facts here, but I came across what our Liberal government had made a big deal with Nestle, a big corporation, and they're allowing Nestle to use our water, all our fresh water, for their purposes, to make their food that is of no value to our health. And who has given our prime minister to give away the water that belongs to the earth, that belongs to all of us? So I think this is a crime against nature, and this is just, you know, it should be on the par with genocide. So I am very upset by this. It seems to be passed into law. So corporations cannot take over the world. The nature belongs to itself, and it's at our own peril that we lose all these, that nature, when nature is destroyed. There's another piece of information I came across from the Organic Consumers Association. the FDA, that's the Food and Drug Administration in Washington, announced that it is revoking the rule that allowed the use of brominated vegetable oil, or BVO, in food because of concerns about the chemical's health, the health harms. The agency's action is a significant step towards protecting public health, given studies that show that brominated vegetable oils are, have harmful effects on the nervous system. The food and direct the food the FDA's decision to ban brominated vegetable oil in food is a victory for public health, but it is disgraceful that it took decades of regulatory inaction to protect consumers from this dangerous chemical, said Scott Faber, the senior vice president of government affairs at the Environment Working Group. It is outrageous that for years Americans have been consuming brominated vegetable oil, which was banned in Europe and Japan. The FDA's belated action on brominated vegetable oil underscores the urgent need for more rigorous and timely oversight of food additives. In lieu of federal action, some states have stepped up. In October 2023, California enacted the California Food Safety Act, the first law in the United States to ban brominated vegetable oil and three other harmful chemicals from food manufactured, distributed, or sold in the state. So anyway, this is always a step forward. As the author of the law banning brominated vegetable oil from foods sold in California, he says, "I am pleased to see that the FDA finally taking action on this harmful chemical," said Gabriel. "This decision aligns with California's commitment to protecting children and families and sets a national standard that will benefit all Americans." While the FDA's announcement is a step forward, allowing brominated vegetable oil to remain in foods for so long, despite clear evidence of harm, highlights a glaring failure in our food safety system. The FDA must act quickly to expedite its reviews and do more to remove harmful and toxic chemicals from our food supply, Gabriel added. In addition to harming the nervous system, brominated vegetable oil has been linked to other health hazards. It also builds up in the body, and research shows a connection between large amounts of brominated vegetable oil containing soda ingested over a long period of time and problems such as headaches, irritation of the skin and mucous membranes, fatigue and loss of muscle coordination and memory. So this is just like bromine and chlorine. They are a class of chemicals called halogens, and they are usually a halogen is usually in the form of a reddish brown liquid that volatilizes to form a vapor, which is an unpleasant odor and irritating to the mucous membranes. So there's our different halogens, and any of the five very reactive non-metallic chemical elements are, and this is the halogens, that their definition is that they are non-metallic chemical elements, and they are fluorine, which is the smallest one, and then there's chlorine, and there's bromine, and there are others. So this is something that I wasn't aware of, that bromine was in the food. I'm not sure. We have to be watchful of labels anyway. So just set that information for what it's worth. And I would like to share a recipe at this point, as we're getting to the end of our program. And I'd like to share a recipe for a spinach cheese manicotti. And the reason I'm sharing this is because we made it in our the group gathering that we had last week or this week at the school. for our the completion of our program, one of our programs, and it's called cheese manicotti, spinach cheese manicotti. So I have to say, we bought the pasta from DeLuca's, and they are very, they have expert, they can give you expert help in what is the better type of pasta to use for different things. So these were round tubal type of pastas that you fill, and they were not the big size, but they were not the longer tubes, but this like maybe a 2-inch type of tube, and not terribly huge, but still a round tube. So that's the type we used. So the recipe calls for a 15-ounce container of ricotta cheese, and a 10-ounce package of frozen chopped spinach, thawed and squeezed dry, and also 1/2 cup of minced onion, and 2 teaspoons of minced fresh parsley, 1/2 teaspoon of pepper, 1/4 teaspoon of garlic powder, or 1/2 clove of garlic finely chopped, and we use finely chopped garlic. 1 1/2 cups of mozzarella cheese that's divided, and 1/2 cup of grated Parmesan cheese divided. And then you need the spaghetti sauce as well, and we made our own. So what you do, you have to cook the manicotti shells or tubes in boiling water until al dente, according to PAG's directions. You don't want them to be completely cooked because they're going to be continuing to cook in the oven. And you preheat the oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. And then in a large bowl, you combine the ricotta, the spinach, the onion, and the egg, and you mix that very well and season with some parsley, pepper, and garlic. And then you mix in 1 cup of mozzarella and 1/4 cup of Parmesan cheese. And then in a separate bowl, you stir together the spaghetti sauce. Oh, forget about that. So this is your filling. So then you take the then in a separate boil you're going to make your spaghetti sauce, and I will give you the recipe for that. It's very simple. So now you spread the tomato sauce at the bottom of a 9 by 13 inch baking dish, and you stuff the manicotti shells with the ricotta mixture, and arrange in a single layer in the dish in the pan. And then you cover with the remaining sauce that you have and sprinkle with remaining mozzarella and Parmesan. And you bake for about 55 minutes or until bubbly. I think you could bake it for less time because it's, anyway. So the tomato sauce is very easy to make. You use olive oil and an onion, and you saute the onion and garlic. You add a teaspoon of oregano and bay leaf and some dried parsley or fresh parsley, some basil, and then you add your 3 cups of fresh tomatoes cut into pieces or canned tomatoes, salt and pepper to taste, and you cook that over a saucepan on medium heat until the onion, you saute the onion until it's soft, onion and garlic, and then add the herbs, and then you add the tomatoes, and then you cook that for a while and simmer for 20 minutes. So that's your tomato sauce. It's very simple to make. And you pour it to the bottom of the pan, and you put the manicotti on top of it. And then you put some more tomato sauce on top of that. You cover it and put it in the oven for, as I said, it says for 45 to 55 minutes. I think you better watch to make sure that it's not overcooked. And it's a very delicious dish, Italian type of recipe. So that takes us to the end of Wooden Spoons. It's been a full morning. Thank you, John, for being our co-host. And I want to thank Fran and Dan DeRook for being our guests, and everybody and the listeners who are listening to our program this morning.
You have been listening to Wooden Spoons, sponsored by Mary Jane's Cooking School on CKUW 95.9 FM. For our podcast, please go to cqw.ca, type Wooden Spoons into the search bar, and the program will be up in just a few hours. Till next time, this is John Dick and Mary Jane Eason saying bye for now, and thanks for listening.